This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, July 16th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Meat and poultry processing plants have always had among the most dangerous jobs in the country. Between 2015 and 2018, every other day on average, a slaughterhouse employee lost a body part or went to the hospital. The work has become even riskier with the spread of COVID-19. The industries have been secretive about the number of infected workers, but unions claim that the dismal conditions at these plants have contributed to the particularly virulent spread of COVID-19 there. Mountaire, one of the country's largest poultry producers, stopped releasing statistics about infected employees after the numbers soared at several facilities. According to Nelson Hill, an official with the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, workers were seeing people disappear and they didn't know what the hell was going on. On an NBC News segment on April 27th, an employee at a Tyson Foods plant in Iowa talked about the conditions there. Employees didn't dare to speak openly for fear of losing their jobs, but they were even more terrified of getting sick.
They didn't have enough material or masks and things like that to provide to us, so they would start giving us different types of rags and stuff.
Jane Mayer, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss what is going on at Mountaire and how its secretive owner is profiting politically and economically from the pandemic. Good to have you back on, Jane.
Great to be with you.
For months, we've been reading about the rampant spread of COVID-19 at these meat and poultry plants. You actually went to Delaware, presumably with your mask and gloves on, to report about the conditions at one of them, a Mountaire facility in Selbyville. What did you find?
Well, I met with a worker whose name I won't use in order to protect her because the workers are really frightened that if they speak out, they may lose their jobs or there'll be some kind of retaliation. But I met with one of the workers there at a truck stop who described the situation to me. And it was really very moving. I mean, she said to me, the one good thing about this pandemic is she said she'd been wanting to speak out for so long. And she said to me, I want these people exposed. It is terrible in there, talking about this company, Mountaire, where she'd worked for more than 10 years off and on. She described a situation that is, I mean, it was really kind of Dickensian. People have said to me as I was reporting this story that it's very much like the kinds of conditions that Upton Sinclair described in 1906 when his sort of expose, The Jungle, came out. And it shocked the nation at that point and the conscience of the nation. And it was the beginning of the federal regulations in the food industry, the beginning of the FDA, because there was such a reaction against these horrible conditions in the meatpacking industry. So we're back in many ways in Upton Sinclair's jungle, is what a number of people who are closely following this told me. And she described what it's like. I mean, it's kind of a horror show. I mean, because the companies are so secretive about what the level of the virus is inside these plants, the workers go to work in the morning not knowing whether people right next to them have it and are contagious. And this woman in particular watched as one friend got sick and then died, and his wife then was on a ventilator, and she describes that in the story. And then another woman who was right next to her, she said, a Guatemalan worker who got sick, she told her supervisor, and the supervisor sent the woman to the nurse at the company, and the nurse sent her right back onto the line to keep working. And eventually that woman did have COVID-19 also, and she was on a ventilator and finally left the company because she said she didn't want to go back. And the woman that I was interviewing said this is an evil, evil company is what she described it as. It's pretty terrifying for the people who work there. They're already being paid terrible wages, really close to minimum wage. They were given a $1 raise by Mountaire for hazard pay for a couple months, and then the company took it back at the end of June, which has really also incensed the workers. And this woman I was interviewing said to me, she knew that the owner had given millions of dollars to Donald Trump. And she said, you know, he gives $2 million to Donald Trump, and he gives us a $1 raise and takes it back. What are we, animals?
This spring, the industry warned that the meat and poultry supply chain was breaking down, and we began to see footage on news shows of shelves containing no meat, and we read reports that processing plants would have to close. That did not happen, and on April 28th, Trump signed an executive order defining employees in these industries as essential workers, so taking care of that potential problem. And as you discovered, Mount Air continued to export chicken to China and Hong Kong. So what about that warning? Was there really a breakdown in the supply chain?
Well, I mean, I am sympathetic to the fear that there might not be enough food in the stores. Remember, there was a lot of panic buying. Yeah. And I can imagine that inside the White House, they thought this would be politically unsurvivable. So I can see what their fear was, but it was not substantiated. I mean, there have been a number of reports talking to experts on the industry who really look at the numbers of the sales of meat and poultry. And what was going on in April and May is that there were record numbers of exports to China of pork. And in the company that I was looking at, Mount Air, their exports to China and Hong Kong went up, as you mentioned. And so was there really a shortage of American meat and poultry? Well, if there was, then why were they sending it abroad? It doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Were they adding people to the assembly line?
Well, basically, if you stand back, what you can see in this story is that this company, Mount Air, is privately owned by a man named Ron Cameron, who is one of the single biggest financial donors to Donald Trump in 2016 and now for the reelection and to the Republican Party. And he has given millions. And the needs of his company were very much met by the Trump administration. Rather than shutting down the plant and killing the profits in the poultry industry, which it would have if they'd had to stop production, what Trump did was he invoked this special measures to keep a business going because of the pandemic. And what he did was he declared poultry workers essential, which meant they had to keep going to work no matter how much COVID there was in their factories. And the chicken lines just kept humming. And the sales kept going because of this. It was horrible for the workers and great for the owner of the company, who happens to be one of his biggest donors.
And they didn't take further precautions to protect workers?
When Trump issued this executive order, at the same time, the Labor Department put out an accompanying order that in essence tells the employers, hey, it would be nice if you followed the health guidelines from the Center for Disease Control, but if you can't do it, no one's going to penalize you. They basically said the standards are unenforceable. We're not going to issue violations if you don't live up to the CDC's guidelines. And so it became completely optional. Now, the people I interviewed at OSHA, which is the agency that usually monitors health and safety of workers and issues violations, people who used to run OSHA, like David Michaels, said to me, this is just unheard of. He ran it in the Obama administration. And what he said was, they're looking out for the employers and not looking out for the workers. And this has just not been, they'd never seen anything quite like before. And so OSHA just basically stopped monitoring these workplaces in any way that mattered.
On one level, it's a continuation of the deregulatory policies Republicans have pushed since Ronald Reagan, but it's more extreme and more insidious. It seems as though the administration is actually leveraging the virus to help industry and further strip away worker protections.
That's exactly right. And so basically what you're seeing is the fruition of this kind of free market ideology that's been sowed by the Kochs, among others, Charles and David Koch, to whom this particular company owner, Ron Cameron, has given some of the biggest corporate donations to the Kochs political network. It's this free market ideology that's been pushing for the last 40 years to get rid of any kind of constraints on business, all kinds of regulations. I mean, the Kochs in 1980 were pushing to get rid of the FDA specifically, among many other agencies. And so what you've seen now, 40 years later, is that this movement has helped create this landscape in which the workers have so few protections. And Trump, when he came in, he and his advisor, Steve Bannon, said that they wanted to deconstruct the administrative state, as they put it. And it was kind of unclear what they really meant. What they meant was they were going to get rid of all these kinds of constraints on business. And it turned out it was kind of hard to do. They got rid of a number of regulations on the first 3 years of the Trump administration. But when the pandemic hit, this became a real opportunity because suddenly you have an emergency and the president can issue emergency orders. And so he has issued a number of executive orders in addition to the one that we've already talked about that basically say to businesses, hey, if you don't want to live up to these regulations, if you want to skip them, if you think that you can argue that they're hurting your profits, then all you need to do is sort of make a good faith effort, but you don't really need to abide by the regulations.
And you mentioned that Cameron's one of Trump's biggest donors. He's also a member of the advisory board that Trump appointed to look at the pandemic's economic impact. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about Cameron himself and the company.
Well, he's very mysterious. So as a reporting challenge, this was hard. He's someone who's been very beneath the radar. He doesn't like attention. And I interviewed, for instance, Max Brantley, who was the editor of the Arkansas Times. And Brantley said to me, I've been trying for years to bump into this guy.
Because that's where Cameron grew up.
Yes, I'm sorry. He's from Little Rock, Arkansas, and his corporate office is still in Little Rock, Arkansas. And at any rate, he has been increasingly a presence that you sense if you cover money in politics, because particularly after 2014, he started making the lists of the largest political donors in the country, giving millions and millions. Yet no one really had much sense of who he was or what he wanted. So I was trying to figure that out. And after a while of reporting and talking to people, I was able to interview a number of people who grew up with him and even one of his sisters, Amanda. And they began to really describe what his background was like and how he was shaped and molded. And what I got was a picture of someone who grew up in a very sheltered, narrow, wealthy community. He inherited the company from his father, who had in turn inherited it from his father. And there are a lot of racial issues having to do with this company. An awful lot of the poultry workers are black and brown. And Little Rock had had a lot of racial strife in the past. And the family's described as having two black servants living above the garage who were basically live-in retainers and took care of the family always. It's a picture of the old South almost.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You mentioned that Mountaire's creed is that they are good stewards of all the assets that God has entrusted to us. But it seems that those assets have mostly gone to fund Cameron's involvement in very socially conservative evangelical groups.
One of the shocking things that I discovered about Ron Cameron was while he was paying his workers so miserably in this company. If you go and you get the forms from the IRS, he's got a private foundation that's called the Jesus Fund. He has put away $327 million in this fund, the Jesus Fund.
And what is the Jesus Fund?
The Jesus Fund is a private foundation that's sort of his personal piggy bank for whatever he thinks is a good cause. And a lot of what he's put that money into are far-right religious organizations, it looks like. It's got a screen that makes it hard to see exactly where the money's gone, but an awful lot of it in the last few years has gone to something called the National Christian Foundation, which in turn funds a ton of evangelical religious groups, and in particular, it gives many, many millions of dollars to something called the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a group that calls itself the anti-ACLU. It's a group that litigates all over the country to challenge gay rights, abortion rights, and take other kinds of socially conservative and religious stances. So he's pouring money basically into the religious right. And it's the money that he's making off the backs of these people who work at Mount Air. So you kind of get to see this picture all in this one story of this one man's life of the way that the campaign finance system works, where a businessman takes profits and plows them into politics, into political campaigns and political groups, which then promote his business interests and his personal interests, and he has more profits to then plow in again. It's a kind of a circular motion machine.
And the other thing that really interested me, you know, when you look at the bigger picture, you cite Anna Stansberry and Larry Summers, who are now two Harvard economists, who attribute the rising income inequality of the past four decades to the collapse of membership in private sector unions. And they argue, as I understand it, that more than any other structural change in the economy, this accounts for nearly all of the gains in the share of income made by America's wealthiest 1%.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, the story opens with a union fight taking place there. The company is close to being able to kick out the United Food and Commercial Workers International, which has represented workers there for the last 42 years. And there's a sort of a titanic clash taking place in this company. And what this paper says, the Economist paper says, is that as unions have diminished, the profits have grown for the people on the top and have almost by equal measure fallen from the earnings on the bottom. And so you can see that somebody like Cameron, his company's done phenomenally well. And meanwhile, the workers in his plant have done worse and worse and worse if you compare them to the national average for manufacturing. So it's just an illustration of the entire economic picture taking place in this country over the last 40 years, and it's coming to a head right now.
And they're as you say, I think they're less well represented by unions than the meatpacking industry.
Yeah, so basically about 2/3 of meatpackers are represented by unions, and only about 1/3 of poultry workers are. And in this one company I was looking at, Mount Air, this is the only plant they have that has a union that still represents anybody in it. Union membership in this country's fallen from its high in the 1950s. Private sector unions, about 35% of the population belonged to them. Now they're down to about 6%. And what you've seen is the power of the workers, according to this paper, has fallen along with union membership. And their political power has fallen. And as it's fallen, the political power and influence of the people on the top has grown.
Getting back to the jungle, Sinclair wrote the book in large part because he wanted readers to pay closer attention to workers' rights. And in that way, he was nudging them toward socialism, he hoped. Instead, they focused on the consumer horrors. I'll quote him. He said, "I aimed at the public's heart and by accident hit it in the stomach." So I wonder if you get any sense that the country is more ready now to get behind workers than it was then.
I do think that the pandemic has, in a way, shone a light on these people that we call essential workers, who really have been mostly invisible until now. And the pandemic has highlighted that, because these are the people who've had such terrible exposure to the virus and so few protections at the workplace.
And if Biden wins the election, presumably it's going to go about reinstating all of these traditional powers of the regulatory agencies. But that alone is going to be an enormous undertaking. And I wondered whether there are democratic efforts underway now to begin that process, either at the federal level or at the state level.
I don't know what Biden's plan is in particular. He's from Delaware, where the poultry industry is really powerful. And I've been interested in what his relationship's been like with it, but I don't know the answer to that. I have seen one spark of hope since my story came out, actually, in Virginia. There is now a push in the state. I think it's succeeding and it's going to go through for the state to have its own OSHA rules. It's going to actually monitor the workplaces and force companies to do the things that the federal OSHA is not doing, including telling employees when they've been exposed to COVID and how many people in their workplaces have it. I mean, these are big secrets in the poultry factories. In Virginia, the employers have to tell workers if they've had cases of the virus, and they've got to live up to the CDC's standards for safe workplaces and healthy workplaces. So, and there's going to be big penalties if they don't, which is exactly what OSHA is not doing. So maybe the states are going to pick up the job that the federal government has, in the words of the New York Times, been AWOL on.
Yeah, and you can see it in other ways, in the way certain governors are dealing with the wearing of masks and everything else.
It's not a perfect solution by any means, because what it's going to do is create a sort of a checkerboard of different states with different rules. And of course, industries can then, you know, flee Virginia, where the standards are higher, and move to a state where they are lower. And so it won't really work as a solution. But temporarily, for the poultry workers in Virginia, there's going to be some help.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Great to be with you.
Jane Mayer is the New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent and the author of Dark Money: The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.